Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A week ago, Citigroup was on life support. Today, CEO Vikram Pandit said, basically, hey, look, we're $8 billion in the black. Great news for the banking industry. But seriously, show me the money. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by CSX, working to reduce traffic and pollution by carrying the load of 280 trucks by rail. CSX, how tomorrow moves. American Public Media presents Repossessing Virtue, fresh thinking on the moral, spiritual, and ethical aspects of the economic downturn. Gain perspective at speakingoffaith.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Tuesday, the 10th of March. So glad you could be with us. And first things first, it's important to point out that what Citigroup said today wasn't exactly official in the SEC sense of the word. CEO Vikram Pandit broke the news of the black ink in an internal email to Citi staffers. Word got out, as word tends to do. And good news of any kind out of the financial sector was all Wall Street needed to hear. So thanks, Citigroup, for today's 379-point bounce on the Dow. I'm sure they'll appreciate it because I don't think they've been getting many thank yous lately. But, and seriously, you knew there'd be a but here, right? You have to bear in mind that Pandit didn't talk about all those troubled assets that Citi still has to keep on marking down. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports now from New York.
That's right. Pandit's memo left out what he calls externally disclosed marks. Those are the company's troubled assets that keep getting marked down. With Citi still trading below $2 a share, his cheerleading sounded positively Python-esque. It was like the fight scene in The Holy Grail, where the Black Knight denies he's been seriously hurt.
'Tis but a scratch.
A scratch? Your arm's off.
No, it isn't.
Well, what's that then?
I've had worse.
Pandit claims Citi is having its best quarter since late 2007. Eileen Fahey is a managing director at Fitch Ratings. She says anyone who takes the memo as a sign we've hit bottom is reading too much into it.
I think that seems very optimistic, particularly compared to yesterday's stories.
Like the ones about powerful lawmakers recommending some of the nation's big banks be allowed to fail. As for Citi's current credit rating from Fitch, Fahey says,
currently they're a single A-plus rating that is, though, highly dependent on the government support.
There are plenty of believers in Citi out there. Anton Schutz is one. He's president of Mendon Capital Advisors, which has Citi stock in one of its funds.
Maybe I'm one of the few people not surprised or shocked, but I thought all the actions cumulatively were going to eventually add up here.
He says Citi has sold off some of the best parts of its business and has already marked down its assets significantly. So why not include those externally disclosed marks?
You know, the marks move all over the place. But, you know, really when the marks matter is the end of the quarter.
April 17th in Citi's case, which is when investors and employees will get, as the late, great Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
House Financial Services Committee Chairman Barney Frank did what he could to put some steel back in Wall Street's spine today. Frank said he wants to see something called the uptick rule put back in effect, perhaps by the end of the month, too. Not to get all complicated on you here, but the uptick rule basically says that short sellers, that is, traders who are betting a stock is going to go down, can only sell short when the last trade in a given stock was up. Prevent piling on a falling stock is what that rule did. The SEC got rid of it, though, back in 2007. And a whole lot of people say that that contributed mightily to the fall of Bear Stearns and the Lehman Brothers and so helped get us where we are today. Where Ben Bernanke was today was making a speech to the Council of Foreign Relations. He said the rules that are supposed to cover this country's troubled financial system need to be rewritten. Congress has already started its debate, so today the Fed chairman laid down his own ideas. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Financial regulation is a balkanized mess. There's the Fed, the FDIC, the CFTC, the SEC, the OTS, and the OCC. Not to mention more than 100 state regulators, too. And Ben Bernanke says it's not working.
We must have a strategy that regulates the financial system as a whole, in a holistic way, not just at its individual components.
So today the Fed chairman outlined his ideas. Bernanke said more institutions that are too big to fail should fail. We should plan for huge failures and figure out how to deal with them in an orderly way. Hal Scott at Harvard says interconnectedness is a problem, too.
The problem we had in the past, if let's say we had one bank that owned $1 billion and it didn't pay, it would cause an unwinding of the entire system.
The banks that got stiffed wouldn't be able to pay their own debts, which is why Lehman Brothers' failure last fall was so terrifying to Wall Street. We have to fix that. Next, Bernanke says, banks should have to set aside more money in good times, so when the economy sours, they'll have enough. And finally, he says someone needs to be looking out for big threats to the entire system and have the powers to head them off. So who gets to wear the cape and tights?
Who else would it be?
Hal Scott says the Fed's record as a regulator isn't that strong, but
I can't say they're very good at what they want to be good at.
And if there is a big systemic failure, it's the Fed and its billions that have to fly to the rescue. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Just like the Fed chairman, President Obama made a speech of his own today, an ambitious plan for pre-K through college education. He brought a long reform list with him that includes boosting Head Start, beefing up the standards for K through 12, maybe even lengthening the school day and year as well. The president also said he's going to push for two big ideas that are not popular with a lot of Democrats, and in particular with teachers' unions, merit pay and charter schools. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
The president was clear and concise on boosting pay for the best teachers.
Too many supporters of my party have resisted the idea of rewarding excellence in teaching with extra pay, even though we know it can make a difference in the classroom.
Teachers' unions are wed to seniority-based pay, but Courtney Vandersteck of the Oregon Education Association says there are many ways to attach dollars to performance.
If you're going to work more, do more than is required, quote, under the contract, there ought to be compensation for that work, such as for mentoring new teachers or writing new curriculum. That's hard to argue with.
What union advocates do argue with is paying more for student achievement, based on standardized tests, for instance. Vandersteck thinks Education Secretary Arne Duncan will be able to find a compromise between teachers and employers, but it's probably going to end up costing the taxpayer.
I do think there's going to be federal money for innovation that helps teachers be more successful in the classroom.
Teachers' unions don't much like charter schools either, but Nelson Smith of the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools says removing restrictions on them won't cost much.
And in terms of the state and local cost, it's not a matter of adding new costs. It's a matter of having the dollars follow the children and letting parents decide where to send their kids.
Critics argue when those dollars leave public districts, there's even less money available to fix struggling schools and reward good teachers. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Crime Blotter, this news today. Bernie Madoff's lawyer said this afternoon the Ponzi schemer is probably going to plead guilty maybe as soon as Thursday. Prosecutors say he's looking at about 150 years in jail. Wall Street took the aforementioned Citigroup news and ran with it. We will have the details when we do the numbers. You know all that extraneous stuff that shows up on your computer screen when you're reading an article online? We call it annoying. The websites call it advertising. And they know most of us just block it out, which isn't so good for paying their bills. Today, a trade group that represents sites like the New York Times and ESPN and a whole mess of others introduced three new kinds of banner ads that are designed to stay with us for a while. Marketplace's Brendan Noonan reports.
They sound like nicknames for a football defensive line. There's the fixed screen, the pushdown, and the XXL. In fact, they're the new offensive strategy for marketers. Pam Huron is the president of the Online Publishers Association, the trade group behind the new ads. The bigger the ad, she says, the more space the advertiser has to tell you about a product.
What this does is provide a larger format for that marketer to engage the consumer and have that brand experience right there on the page.
Online publishers are also fighting what they call banner blindness. Emily Riley at Forrester Research says that's when consumers see so many ads, they start blocking them out.
If you have a big, beautiful ad from a good advertiser right in the middle of the page, then you are forced to pay attention.
But internet surfers don't like being forced to do anything. So advertisers are hoping these ads will capture a viewer's attention without annoying them. And if consumers don't like it?
It's a very unique time with the economy being so low. I think that all of these sites are looking for ways to entice advertisers to spend more. They might be a little less sensitive to consumer backlash as a result.
In other words, prepare to be annoyed. From Los Angeles, I'm Brendan Noonan for Marketplace.
Chinese consumers got a break today. Beijing reported consumer prices fell more than 1.5% last month. It is just the latest sign that the once hot, now not Chinese economy is having the same troubles the rest of us are. And that could be a factor in how fast we all get out of this mess. We've got our China correspondent Scott Tong on the line with us. Hey, Scott.
Hello, Kai.
So we all know, sadly, how a recession feels here. What does it feel like in an economy like China?
Well, it's bad and it's not so bad here. Let me tell you what I mean.
Right.
My 5-year-old daughter, Audrey, a couple weeks back, comes and declares that her self-appointed Korean boyfriend in her kindergarten class is no longer there. Right? He's moved back to Korea forever, unquote. And it turns out tens of thousands of Koreans have actually left Shanghai. A lot of Japanese have left as well because of how bad the economies there are back home. So what that shows us is the global economy part of China is bad. Multinational companies who are here to manufacture stuff or sell stuff, or the people who give advice to these companies how to do it, you know, lawyers and financial consultants, a lot of them are flat on their back. On the other hand, you can't get a taxi in Shanghai. 45 minutes on Saturday, and I'm just sitting there trying to get one. What that tells us is there are other parts of the Chinese economy that are still moving, the domestic China store. Millions of people buying their first car, their first life insurance policy, their first microwave oven. So it's a kind of slowdown, and the numbers reflect that.
So is there a pressure for Beijing, for the government to do something about it? And if so, what?
Well, the government is in all-out stimulate the economy mode. Remember way, way back in 1992, all of us Americans were saying it's the economy, stupid. Well, here, it's employment, stupid. 6 million or more unemployed college graduates, 20 to 30 million unemployed migrants who used to work in factories that aren't operating anymore. So the government's answer is massive stimulus. They've put out $500 billion to try to help exporters stay afloat, to tell banks to lend like mad, and China's building stuff. Roads, train tracks, power lines, cell phone towers. So a lot of scaffolding all over China.
What about those, Scott, when you go out and report stories? What are workers in the Chinese economy telling you? Are they looking to the government to pull them out of this?
Talk to migrants and you do feel the pain. There's more anxiety about what their next job is going to be. But do they look to the government to fix their problems? I don't hear that very often. The Communist Party a generation ago kind of ditched this thing called the Iron Rice Bowl, where the government takes care of your entire life. And so a lot of migrants in China have to depend on themselves. The example that I often think of is the man we call to drive us to the airport when we go on a trip. He's had like 7 jobs in his career. He's in his 40s. He used to ride this 3-wheel bicycle to carry bricks around Shanghai, recycling stuff, and then he drove a taxi, and now he drives a van for hire. These Chinese migrants often have this amazing capacity to reinvent themselves, and I think there's going to be a lot of this trial and, or maybe error and trial for a little while, and then we'll see how desperate things get. But it doesn't feel like we're there yet.
What's your sense, though, Scott, about how quickly China might be able to turn it around? Do you think that China might be able to come out of this more quickly than the United States?
Well, you don't see it yet. That's for sure. This week, there's a lot of angst about deflation hitting the Chinese economy. Trade numbers later this week are going to be awful. The optimists say China may emerge first this summer. And the reason is, well, the West had 2 problems. It had a bank problem and it had a real economy, human being problem. And China's just had one. So they have to work on the economy and get jobs for people. But the banks are in very good shape. I mean, sure, they have the efficiency of the DMV when you walk in, but they lend. They lend a lot. So maybe signs in the next few months that China might be bottoming out. That's the good case scenario.
Scott Tong in Shanghai for us. Thank you, Scott.
All right, Kai. Nice to talk to you.
Today's buying spree on Wall Street might make you wonder whether now is the time to dip your toe into those turbulent market waters. But how do you get your bearings in times like these? Commentator and economist Susan Lee has been drawn to the high seas.
In a recession, the world is divided into 2 types: the worrywarts, who obsessively check the value of their 401ks, and the optimists, who start looking for the bottom. So let's say you want to be the second type of forward-looking person. What do you do? Well, a lot of people watch the leading indicators. These are 10 indices put out by the Conference Board, which track variables like the S&P, consumer confidence, and new building permits. Fine. Except the leading indicators don't have a perfect track record. In the past, they've given off lots of false signals. For example, leading indicators often predict recession when none happens. They've falsely predicted 5 recessions since 1959. Even more problematic, the leading indicators track U.S. performance. Important, yes, but not totally on the point for a global recession. So I have something better. I suggest you watch an index that will tell you when the world economies are starting to perk up and when trade conditions are really starting to ease. It's called the Baltic Dry Index. Essentially, the Baltic Dry tracks the average daily price for shipping dry bulk, like coal, iron ore, wheat, and soybeans. There are 3 things that make it such a good leading indicator. 1, the index looks at raw materials, so it captures activity at the very beginning of the production process. 2, it looks at ocean shipping, so it reveals what's happening to international trade, the critical driver of global growth. And 3, the shipping business depends heavily on credit, so the Baltic Dry indicates whether credit is tight or loose. Back in 2005, when the world's economies were just fine and credit was abundant, the Baltic Dry looked like a powerhouse. But it peaked in May of 2008, and it's been heading almost straight down ever since, losing about 90% of its value. So forget about your 401k and start paying attention to the Baltic Dry. And here's the really nice thing about starting now. You missed the 6-month worry wart part when it tanked in such a nauseating fashion. In fact, one could almost say the Baltic Dry has nowhere to go but up.
Susan Lee is an economist living in New York City. You can share your thoughts with us online. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. The Baltic Dry, by the by, has been up the past couple of days. Coming up, checking in with your doctor from your couch.
I pull the machine out, put the batteries in, do the read, it sends it, and that takes about 5 minutes. And it immediately sends me an email message saying your report has been received.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials bounced 379 points today. That is 5.8% to close at 6,926. The Nasdaq soared 89.7%, settled at 1358. The S&P 500 rebounded 43.6 3/10%, wrapped up at 719. Citigroup shares surged 38% today after Vikram Pandit's memo that we told you about. Bank of America recovered 27%. J.P. Morgan Chase took back 22%. Wells Fargo rolled ahead 18%. Signs that OPEC might rein in supply at Sunday's meeting pushed up oil prices and goosed energy shares. ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips both jumped around 4%. Chevron gained around 6% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.01%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap in marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
State Book, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Treasury Department releases the federal budget for February. The Senate Rules and Administration Committee holds a hearing on problems with voter registration. And a House subcommittee on financial institutions and consumer credit explores ways to reform the American mortgage system. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Environmental Protection Agency said today it wants to know exactly how many tons of greenhouse gases American factories are producing every year. It is still just a proposal, but if it does wind up happening, it would be the first comprehensive plan we've had for reporting greenhouse gas emissions. As it stands now, this country's power plants and automakers, oil refineries, and all the rest release more than 25,000 metric tons of global warming gases every year. Sarah Gardner is here from the Sustainability Desk to explain. Hey, Sarah.
Hi, Kai.
This is one of those stories that we call processy. It's just about the grind of rulemaking in the government. What does it actually mean, though?
Kai, this is really the first step toward regulating greenhouse gases in this country. If you're going to impose a cap on greenhouse gas emissions, you have to know how much these industries are emitting, and we don't know that right now. This would affect some 13,000 facilities around the country, everything from power plants to oil refineries. Congress ordered the EPA to do this back in 2007. The Bush administration refused. Now it looks like it's going to happen.
What do we know from the people who would be subjected to these limits, the manufacturers who are out there?
Well, there may be some initial quibbling, but some of this reporting, frankly, is going on already. Power plants, for example, have to measure and report their acid rain emissions, and in doing so, they capture the CO2 data. So that's going on already. But environmentalists say it's important to start measuring and get this data before you do a cap and trade program. Europe did not do that, and the results weren't good. This is David Doniger at the Natural Resources Defense Council.
When the first emissions reports came out of Europe, they had overestimated how much pollution their facilities were emitting, and they had issued too many permits. So they had a crash in the price of the permits.
And some would argue, of course, that Europe's cap and trade program has been struggling to recover ever since.
Yeah, a lot of people would, actually. If this is, as you say, the first step toward regulating carbon, what does the economic picture look like? Because if there's going to be a cap and trade bill, will that happen in a down economy?
Yeah, it's going to be difficult to pass. First, though, the EPA may beat Congress to the punch. Word is that as early as April 2nd, the EPA may declare CO2 a threat to human health, and that triggers a rulemaking process towards regulating greenhouse gases. But the preferred route for many environmentalists, anyway, is legislation. And it is going to be a big fight in Congress. Already opponents have been framing this as a huge energy tax on the American public in the middle of a recession. And depending on how the economy is faring this spring and this summer, it could be very difficult to pass this.
Yeah, as so much else depends. Sarah Gardner from the Sustainability Desk. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
There are billions of dollars in the stimulus plan going into healthcare, electronic healthcare to be more precise. Along those lines, Kaiser Permanente published two studies in the journal Health Affairs today. Both doctors and patients inside the Kaiser system who were asked about it said online patient records worked out pretty well for them. The prospect of somebody who shouldn't actually getting their hands on your electronic records has always been the big bugaboo. But now patients carry their data around with them. Computer chips are in just about everything these days, including us. And that makes it possible for doctors to track vital signs and medical conditions without so much as an office visit. Marketplace's Caitlin Carroll reports that the future of the wired patient could be pretty healthy.
Like a lot of heart patients, Robert Biller has a defibrillator implanted in his heart that controls its rhythm. But his defibrillator is special. It has a chip that records his heart's activity and then sends it off electronically to his doctor.
And when it comes time to do a reading, I just take out the microphone, plug this into a telephone jack, put the microphone on my heart, and turn the machine on.
Biller waits for the light to turn green. That means his device has finished uploading all the data it's collected since the last time he plugged in. The information goes to a website where his cardiologist can review what Biller's heart's been up to for the past few weeks. And that is the old technology.
Now it's completely different. There are about, I would guess, nearly 500,000 patients with networked implanted devices now, and the newest generation uses cellular technology, so there's no connection, there's no use of the phone line.
That's Leslie Saxon, Biller's doctor and head of cardiovascular medicine at the University of Southern California. Those network devices she's talking about are instruments that let doctors monitor patients remotely and over time. Saxon says these round-the-clock readings provide a much fuller picture of a patient's health.
It sort of takes the artificial out of medical care, meaning that we see a patient, we get a snapshot in time, and we get some data, but we really don't have any real sense of how that patient's doing in their daily life.
Medical companies are pouring money into the technology. They're already making scales, blood pressure cuffs, and insulin pumps that relay information to your doctor. And there's some sci-fi stuff in the works, like smart pills that transmit reports as they travel through the body, and pill boxes that will text you if grandma skips her medication. Greg DeLisavoy is a health economist and an adjunct professor at Johns Hopkins University.
Technology tends to bubble along for quite a while, and then all of a sudden forces come together and it starts gaining traction, and that's where we are right now in this technology.
And moving fast, there's $20 billion of stimulus money for creating a national system of electronic health records. IBM and Google are developing software that will let patients put information from their portable medical devices into their records. That way, patients' data can travel with them doctor to doctor. But there are kinks to be worked out.
I think the organizational barriers are one of the major issues. I mean, this is a new way to practice medicine.
Privacy and training are huge issues, and there needs to be a system for paying doctors when they monitor patients online. Also, this technology might not save money. The more health problems portable devices pick up, the more treatment patients could require. But UCLA health policy professor Gerald Kaminsky says early diagnosis could help people live longer.
And that often is the case in healthcare, that we end up getting better outcomes, but in order to do that, we have to spend more. It's difficult to find lots of good examples of true cost-saving technologies.
For now, the true savings may come down to time and peace of mind for patients like Biller.
It doesn't eliminate the need for occasional contact with the medical care professionals, but it certainly reduces the frequency of that and increases the confidence of the patient.
So no matter where he is, Biller knows that his doctor can follow every beat of his heart. In Los Angeles, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, Dateline Boston, circa the mid-1980s, and the television show Cheers. The bar that that show was named after was a real place, actually in Boston, and it got ridiculously popular after the show hit it big. 5,000 people would pass through on a weekend. But today, the realities of the recession hit home. Eddie Doyle was a bartender at the Real Cheers for 35 years. He's been laid off. The owner said it's pretty simple. Business is way, way down. Doyle's last day is going to be the end of this month. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow shot up 379 points, 5.8%, closed at 6,926. NASDAQ gained 89.7%, settled at 1268. The S&P 500 rebounded 43.6.3%. Thanks today to Jennifer Collins, Renita Jablonski, and Doug Krisner on our morning report crew. Coming up next time on this program, a young pilot with a great idea.
I used to fly up to Westchester County and see these headquarters at Xerox and IBM, and I used to watch the requirement to charter these small planes, and they were spending thousands of dollars, and I just got thinking about that.
It's another conversation from the corner office, this time with FedEx CEO Fred Smith. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.